it's midnight. Come on and trade in your old dreams for new, your new dreams for old.
That's Petra Van Noyes singing Ambe. Dennis Luxion playing. I'm Rick Hogan. The show's After Hours. It's abbreviated because of the Blackhawks game, and it's fitting somehow that the one of my favorite authors, Brian Grewley, who will be in here, who is in here to talk about his latest novel, Bleak Harbor, is also like one of the great amateur hockey players in America. Is that correct, Brian?
I'm an amateur. That's correct.
You are, but you're many of your pictures, devoted Red Wings fan, aren't you?
I love the Wings.
Did.
Yes. And God bless Gordie Howe.
You don't dislike the Hawks, though.
No, I do not. They're great, great hockey organization, great hockey team, great players. Love going to Hawks games and watching them. But if it's Wings Hawks, forget it, pal.
You also play with some regularity with a mutual friend of ours, Chuck Cherney, who happens to be a great amateur golfer and maybe not such a great amateur hockey player, but a wonderful guy.
A great guy. Love seeing Chuck. I play with him at 6:30 a.m. At the Hawks practice facility, the MB Ice Arena there at Ogden and Jackson. Hi, Chuck. I hope you're out there,
Chuck,
listening.
I know you're,
right now
you're
I'm buying lots of my books.
Yeah, you're a devoted listener to this show, I know, Chuck. This latest book, I have sitting in my closet, Brian, a incredibly ratty, I-will-not-throw-away long-sleeve T-shirt. It says Starvation Lake, which you gave away. Is it rare now? Should I put it up on eBay or something?
They were always rare. Yes. Yes, you should put it on eBay. You might get $4.
I'll take anything. No one will let me wear it. That was your first novel. It was one of a sort of Starvation Lake trilogy. You were then with the Wall Street Journal?
Yes, I was with the Wall Street Journal, and I wrote those three books. Yes.
What is it that compelled you? I know that it is the dream and the apocryphal tale that every newspaper man has an unfinished novel in their desk, but fewer and fewer newspaper men write books, or newspaper women. What is it that compelled you relatively deep into your career to say, well, I think I am a novelist?
I always, you know, when I was a kid, I wanted to write novels. Yeah. It was really, that's what I wanted to do as a writer when I was youngster.
Did you study writing in college?
Well, I was an English major, and I thought I would be, I thought I would go to law school, and I just got sick of going to school and doing papers for people and stuff. And so I went into newspapering, which was really a detour to me. That I always thought I would write novels, and you know what? I had nothing to say when I was 21 years old.
Yeah.
And some readers would say I still don't have anything
to
say.
You know, one of the things, ladies and gentlemen, as Brian Grewley stays on until 11 o'clock, you will realize that he's remarkably self-effacing. I think, and I really believe too self-effacing. I can occasionally dip into that too. I know even Marcus Sakey, our mutual friend, even successful authors I know can dip into that, well, I'm not worthy kind of stuff.
Oh, I'm worthy.
Okay. What compelled you to sit down and write Starvation Lake? To take it all, I'm sure as a reporter you were doing a ton of writing on the side, perhaps, but what was it? Was there a catalyst for producing that first book?
I just wanted to try to write a novel. And one of my good friends then, he passed away last year, Brian Doyle, he actually appears right at the end of Bleak Harbor. His name appears. And he was a real novelist, essayist, poet, the best writer I ever knew personally.
Wow.
And Doyle would say to me, you just want to sign books at your book signing, you know? And, you know, he was digging me. He was giving me a dig, excuse me. And
yeah.
But I really wanted to write a novel. So, anyway, I had an idea, and I wrote about 25,000 words, which is
about a
quarter of a novel. And my agent didn't like it, very much. There was this very small...
What were you doing with an agent before you...
I wrote a nonfiction book.
First one, yeah.
Yeah, and I was, you know, the way I got the agent was I knew somebody who knew somebody. Anyway, the 25,000 words I wrote, she didn't like, but there was a little glimmer of hockey in it.
Mm.
And she said, why don't you write me a book about these middle-aged guys who play hockey in the middle of the night? And I immediately had an idea, which became Starvation Lake.
Gus Carpenter, that was the name of the reporter, correct?
That's correct.
Well, Augustus, I don't have Alzheimer's yet.
Augustus Carpenter.
Augustus Carpenter, yeah. For a small paper in
that
Starvation
goes back
Lake.
To my Kalamazoo Gazette days.
Yeah. All of your books are set in fictitious, but if you know the area, not so fictitious Michigan cities.
Yes.
Small, kind of beleaguered Michigan cities. The town in Bleak Harbor... And Bleak, B-L-E-A-K, named after a family, a very fascinating, right. Fascinating family. So you use what you know, correct? I mean,
yeah,
these are
to
places
some
you've been. Yeah, yeah, of course, to some degree. Places, let's go through the Starvation Lake trilogy.
Sure.
The first one was a hit. Would you categorize
it
as a hit?
Yeah, it did very well. It was nominated for an Edgar Award, won a bunch of other awards, sold very well, 12 printings. Yeah.
Did you think I'm out of the newspaper? I'm out
no.
of the journalism?
No, never. I did not think that, no.
Did the other two books, were they conceptualized at the same time? How did the
No, you know, I wrote Starvation Lake. I didn't even know it was a mystery. I just wrote a book. You know, I read very widely. There are a lot of people I know now who just read mysteries and
no
trilogies, and they just read. They get one author, and they read all of his or her work. And I'm not making any judgments. I just was not familiar with that, and so I wrote Starvation Lake. I just thought it was a story, and my agent said it's a literate mystery. Okay, and 26 publishers disagreed that it was anything. And
is
then,
that right?
Yeah, 26 rejections of that book. And then all of a sudden, Touchstone, imprint of Simon & Schuster, said, give us three.
Wow.
So I was like, oh, okay, I just planned on writing this one. And then I wrote one in between Starvation Lake and Hanging Tree that I had to throw away because it was so bad.
Really?
Yeah.
I want to get in the second half hour into this fascinating essay you wrote for Publishers Weekly about taking a sabbatical to finish your next book and what that did for you. But let me talk to you about in being a full-time reporter for the Wall Street Journal and for Bloomberg Business. What's your fiction writing schedule like? How do you carve out the time? Because it is not, let's dissuade people, it is not an easy thing, ladies and gentlemen, to write a novel. It is not like writing a newspaper story. It's not like writing a bunch of newspaper stories. It's a different creature altogether. How, between that and your amateur hockey career, how do you carve out the time?
I just get up and write for an hour and a half. Or
every morning?
Yeah.
Or you try?
Most, you know, during the week, mornings, on the weekends, maybe I move it into the afternoon. But, you know, it's not a, it's just something
it's
you do
like,
every day.
It's not digging ditches, but there is.
No,
a, I do believe there's an.
Some days it feels like that.
I sure it does. But there's an incredible amount of discipline that it takes. Do you not agree?
I don't want to, you know, pat myself on the back, but, you know, you got to just, you know, it's like anything, Rick. You got to do the work, right?
Well,
I have a sticker on my laptop. It's
that
a quote
say?
That Jack London supposedly said, the author of The Call of the Wild. He said, you can't just wait around for inspiration. You have to hunt it down with a club.
That sounds
meaning
like Jack London.
You have to do the work. Yeah. Just do the work. And it's true about anything, not just writing anything. You have to just do the work. And
that's a good, healthy attitude. We got to take a commercial break, but you're going to be on all the way till 11.
Yeah, I'm not going anywhere.
We will spend the last half hour talking all about Bleak Harbor. The next segment, I want to talk more about the Starvation Lake trilogy and why. There are some people, I'm not among them, but would say, hey, man, you're on to something here. Why don't you just stay in Starvation Lake. I don't know if publishers thought that or if your publisher wanted that. I don't know, but we'll find out. Of Petra Van Noyes. This, in a sense, is the voice of Brian Grulli. This is the beginning of Chapter 6, and it just is an example of his stylish writing and descriptive way with words. This, to my mind, is a portrait in only a few sentences of a really screwed-up marriage. The sun is gone. Pete and Carrie sit in the Adirondacks overlooking their beach. Pete on his fourth old style, Carrie her second Scotch Rocks. They haven't said a word in an hour. That couple is as interesting as any I've recently encountered in fiction. They are among the many characters in Bleak Harbor. We'll talk more about that book in a while. Was it hard for you, Brian Grulli, to leave Starvation Lake after three very accomplished books set there?
It wasn't hard to leave, Rick. It was hard to figure out a new place.
Mm.
I was kind of done with Starvation Lake, not in a bad way. I was I completed this. It was an accidental trilogy, but it ended up being, it was just three books, actually four, because I threw out the one in the middle.
Right, the one
of them
that really
was terrible. But then I had to create a whole new place, and that was challenging, but different and fun. And, you know,
it took
that's,
you, it
that's
took,
what we do.
It took you longer. It took you,
took me too long.
It took you 4 years.
Took me too long. Yeah.
Why?
But, you know,
why?
Partly I didn't have a publisher.
Mm-hmm.
So I had no deadline.
Right.
And I just took a new job at Business Week magazine, challenging job, you know, writing long features. And I wanted to do well. And three kids got married. Two grandsons.
Wow.
Life, you know.
Yeah, life gets in the way.
Good.
Life gets in the way.
Good life.
Also, though, what those first three books, even the first book, did was sort of not plunge you into the Chicago literary community, but make you part of the literary community where you formed really good and beneficial, I think, in some ways, friendships. But also, I would see you at the early Printers Row things, and you liked being part of that scene.
They let me buy them beers. Yes.
That's all. He's got a real job. Yeah, yeah. Wait, he works for a newspaper.
Yeah, they let me hang out with them. Yeah, a lot of nice people here in Chicago, a lot of great writers.
Yeah. Well, among them is our mutual friend Gillian Flynn, who has been quite a success. Her movie Widows.
She's done pretty well. Yeah.
Well, she deserves to do pretty well because
God
she's
bless
also
her.
Like the nicest person.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's really ridiculous.
Yeah, tell these people it is ridiculous.
And you know, you read her characters and you're like, this woman has a sick thing in her head.
Yeah.
And then you meet her and you're like,
and you meet her husband, you meet her kids.
Yeah, like she's like the girl next door.
She really is.
If she wanted to kill you.
She really is. She calls Bleak Harbor an electric bolt of suspense. What do you think this book, if you didn't think that Starvation Lake was a mystery, I've read a couple very interesting and provocative reviews of this book where a couple of the reviewers are not quite sure what to call it. One of them, and I'll read his take at length, calls it like a thriller, a suspense novel, a mystery, all these things rolled into one, and none of these things. What do you call it, Brian? I know this is the age where in order to market and merchandise a book, it has to fit usually into a category to make it easier for booksellers to pitch it. What do you call it?
Certainly it's crime fiction.
There's a crime.
I made it up. It's truly fake news. and I would say it's a mystery because there's a question.
Yes.
That the author must answer by the end of the book. I would posit that many, many, many novels, you know, Holden Caulfield is in an asylum. How did he get there? That's a question that J.D. Salinger answers at the end. Not to beg a comparison here, but I think it's more of a thriller in the sense that it moves faster than
sure
the Starvation Lake books did.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a story. They're just stories to me.
That's good,
Rick.
That's good.
I don't care if you call it good and call me for dinner. You know.
Well, I call the book extraordinary. Frankly,
thank you.
We got to take another commercial break, but Brian's going to be on all through 11 o'clock. I want to tell you about it. A few weeks ago, we hit on the show a. Terrific and sensitive jazz singer named Lori Shelley. And so Lori is doing, this is a horrifying story. A great friend of hers named Ralph Wilder was giving a concert and was he suffered a freak accident when a huge projector screen fell on him, on his head, and he's now paralyzed from the chest down. So a bunch of people are giving a benefit on Monday, December 10th at 8 o'clock at Northeastern Illinois University to kind of help, you know where that is, 5500 North St. Louis Avenue, to help kind of pay for his care because he's never going to walk again. Ralph Wilder's the name. There is also a GoFundMe page. I'll tell you more about this a little later. Now it's time for commercials, right, Aubrey? Aubrey Mumpower is leaving this revered institution, not right this second, after 32 years running this station. I'll miss you. Now some commercials.
Hey there, I did be a moonlight saving time so I could love that man of mine. And to the birdies waking chime, good morning.
Welcome back to the show. It is me and Brian Grulli, and here is a review. Brian will be at the bookseller, one of Chicago's, one of the Midwest's great independent bookstores in the heart of Lincoln Square, Tuesday night with Jonathan Eig, a frequent guest on this show, who wrote the, among many books, his latest, the magnificent, and I think definitive biography of Muhammad Ali, a difficult man to catch, and John caught him and got him and put him on the page. And there's a big surprise in the paperback edition of Brian Grulli, John's great friend, will take full responsibility that when you go to the bookseller at 7 o'clock Tuesday night, you can have drinks at the bookseller. That's one of the things that makes
that.
It. Oh, it's a great place.
And it's a great store.
He will be. It is a great, great store. Brian will be, after that, in Arizona, sitting in a bookstore with the best-selling author, Michael Conley, who has sold millions of books.
I'm going to try to give him a little boost.
Yes.
Sales boost.
Try
to get him over the 75 million mark.
You're such an altruist.
That's why
you're
I'm there.
Such an altruist. What is this, from Publishers Weekly? No, in the Arizona Republic, there's a piece today. You can get it online. Just Google Brian Grulli and Michael Conley. Just Google Brian Grulli. The writer of this piece, Robert Englund, who I think is going to be interviewing both
yes.
of you guys.
That's right.
He writes this about Bleak Harbor. It defies classification, making it easier to define it by what it is not. It is not a detective thriller, nor is it a mystery, police procedural, revenge fantasy, or chase story. Yet Grulli somehow combines elements from all these genres to drive a propulsive neighborhood about small-town drama and big-city crime. The book, he says, pivots on the kidnapping of a 15-year-old. And what distinguishes this book for me and distinguishes it from the Starvation Lake trilogy, which I enjoyed tremendously, is there are so many interesting and screwed up characters in this book. There are deep, dark secrets. Almost everybody in this book, even, I think, the reporter for the small paper, who eventually winds up running for the Tribune, does she not?
Right at the end,
yeah,
yes.
Right at the very end. These are not nice people, most of them, Brian.
I think,
they're damaged. They're flawed.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean they're not nice people.
I'll give you that.
I think if you met Pete Peters, who is the boy who's kidnapped Danny's stepdad, you'd like Pete. If you met his mom, Carrie, you would like Carrie.
Those were the two sitting on the porch that I read to you.
Right?
Yeah.
You would like them if you met them, especially Pete. Pete's just, he's a screw-up, and he's a good guy. Certainly Michelle Higgins, who is
the reporter
who appeared...
I like all reporters.
Briefly, yes. Yeah. Well, there's a couple I didn't like that much, but
that's a longer show.
Michelle Higgins appears briefly in two of the Starvation Lake books, and now she's more fleshed out, and I love Michelle.
Yeah.
They're nice people. They're good people, but are they flawed? Yeah, like all of us.
Yeah.
Except, present company accepted.
Yeah.
It's online. You'll see people say unlikable character, and I told my wife this is the T-shirt you should get me for this book. She gets me T-shirts for my books
for everyone.
She finds a really bad quote from a review. One was random suspenseful trash. That's a great T-shirt I have, and unlikable character should be the T-shirt I have from this because In the mystery genre, this is not a cozy. If you want a bunch of happy people,
I don't like happy people. It's like
I don't find them very interesting.
Yeah,
I drink beer with them, but
yeah. But the point is, the point in this book is flawed people are more interesting. They may not be nice. They may have nice moments. But they absolutely, people with secrets are more interesting than people who, is Santa Claus, a store Santa Claus who has some deep, dark secret is much more interesting to me than the store Santa Claus who is nothing but who's an avuncular uncle.
Donald Trump's way more interesting than Barack Obama. That's not a political statement. He's way more interesting.
This must have been, it did take you 4 years to write this.
Yeah, it took me forever.
Because you didn't have a publisher and all that other stuff.
Yeah. But I was lazy.
But you must have. You've created in Bleak Harbor a very interesting. I don't think it gets to you. It's near the end where you start to tell the history of this Joseph Estes who came there from Boston in 1868 to sort of found this weird town. And the matriarch in the book, who is the grandmother. Well, let's tell people what it's about. At the beginning, a 15, almost 16. This is a hard book to talk about without giving too much away.
Danny Peters is 15 years old. He's going to turn 16.
Yes.
He gets kidnapped.
He's autistic.
He's a special kid.
Yeah.
And he's not a cuddly disabled kid like in many special needs kid like in a lot of novels. And he's smart and he's obsessed with certain things.
Dragonflies
is one of them. And the Cubs. He loves the Cubs. And Danny is born into a family of great wealth, the Bleaks. They came to this town. They came to southwestern Michigan in the 1860s, and Joseph Estes Bleak he dug out a swamp and built a timber mill, and then a steel mill, and a newspaper, and he's one of the great entrepreneurs of that time. I'm working on a story right now that involves Aurora. It's just Aurora, Illinois, a suburb west of Chicago. And I was reading, I'm like, it's the same guy. It's Joseph Estes Bleak. In fact, the guy's name is Joseph.
No.
It's some other name, but
it is.
Who founded Aurora. Yeah. And he said, I'm going there and I'm going to build a town. And he did. He built this town on the river there. And so, and as often happens, the later generations
screw it all up. Yeah, that is as often happens and as usually happens.
And Danny is left there to suffer and deal with this.
One of the sort of propulsive elements of the book are, and it's not overdone at all, are text messages that pepper the action. Some of them, I think, get sort of increasingly disturbing. You have until the end of the week, and then I'll be at your door V-Day between us for now. And then even after the kidnapping, the kidnapper asks for a very odd number. And then he ups that number by $2 million later on when he realizes.
Who wouldn't? Might as well.
Well, because he knows that both of the parents are having their own particular, aside from the kidnapping. You can talk about that. Pete runs a marijuana dispensary in Michigan.
Yeah, Pete's a former grains trader from Chicago.
You're traders. There are a lot of traders in the book. I like that.
Yeah, he was a trader in Chicago, and he was good, and then he wasn't that good, and so he ends up putting his money into medical marijuana, opens a practice in Bleak Harbor, thinks this is going to be easy. It's not that easy. It's a business. It's a hard business. I've actually written about this for Business Week.
Sure.
It's a difficult business, and he ends up trying to find easy ways to fix things, and that gets him in trouble. But he can't tell. He can't tell Carrie, his wife. Can't tell her about it because she didn't want to come to Bleak Harbor to do this in the first place.
Yeah.
And Carrie's got her own issues.
Well, Carrie is a fascinating, again, nice is a word that we should never mention again on the show, but Carrie's got her own problems with a boss of hers who is doing some bad things, and she's trying to...
Yeah. I didn't think of this.
Right.
I conceived of what happens with Carrie and her boss.
But then she knows...
Long before
she
Me Too.
Knows some things about her boss that her boss would not like more people.
He's a logistics guy. Like there are many of these, a lot of logistics firms in Chicago, and he's a big-time logistics guy in Chicago, and... He's supposed to be moving grains and widgets, and he's moving some other stuff that Carrie happens to find out about.
Yeah, and Pete gets involved in some the classic unsavory characters. Another word I hate, unsavory.
Yeah.
But
That's kind of a nice word for the character you're talking about.
Oh, yeah. Do you plot these, or do you loosely plot them? It seems to me there is such a strong narrative drive to this book that certain parts of it seem to, and I'm not trying to assume the way you write, but some parts of it are so forceful that I think that if it was plotted out and you were taking little notes about characters, that it would not be so forceful.
Short answer, Rick, is I don't outline or plot. I sort of know what's going to happen. And then I let it go. And then as I'm going, I'm writing the next book now that's also set in Bleak Harbor. And so I'll get so far along, and then I start to make notes about what I have to change earlier to accommodate what I'm going to do next. And then there are characters who I don't know are going to be important, and then they become important. So there's one in Bleak Harbor. His name is Quartz.
Oh.
Quartz,
yes.
Like the multifaceted stone.
Stone.
And Quartz was supposed to be in the book for approximately two pages.
Uh-huh.
One scene with his boss, Randall Pressman, who's a logistics guy we talked about a minute ago. And but then he gets there, and I'm like, well, I have to know a little bit about the guy. What's his history? And then I figure out his history, and I'm like, okay, well, we're going to put him in one more scene, and then the next thing you know... Quartz is a major character.
Oh, no doubt.
And I
no
love
doubt.
Quartz.
And if he's not
in fact, Marcus Seki, my friend, goes, why don't you make the whole book about Quartz? I'm like, dude, I'm done with the book. I'm not rewriting the book.
I may bring him in this next book.
It's taking me 4 years. I can't take another year.
I know. Brian, it's quite an accomplishment. We've got to take another commercial break. The book is Bleak Harbor. The website, which will give you all of Brian's work and on his schedule of events and all sorts of other things, is Brian, BrianGrulley.com. Do check out that website. I can't buy the long sleeve t-shirts there, but somewhere I'm going to find an old Starvation Lake t-shirt.
Might even get a Bleak Harbor t-shirt.
You have them? Book selling now, ladies and gentlemen, is all promotion. Gillian Flynn, whose movie Widows is out right now, says that this book is an electric bolt of suspense. We'll be right back.
Setting my being completely on fire. You and the night and the music thrill me, but will we be one after the night and the music?
Welcome back. I only have a few more minutes, maybe. What are we leaving, Aubrey, at 7? Okay, I have exactly 7 minutes more with Brian Grulley. I don't know what
it'll
to do.
It'll be a great 7 minutes.
We've already had our great 7 minutes was in the last 45. I don't know what I can do to convince you. The book Bleak Harbor was formally on sale December 1st. It is a remarkable book with a number of characters you will never forget. Some might haunt you, but you will never forget these characters. Brian took after finishing this book and getting a two-book deal with Amazon.
Yeah, basically. With Amazon's Thomas and Mercer imprint.
Yeah, which is a very interesting...
It's a terrific experience with them.
I'll bet. The same Marcus is for Marcus Sakey, noted authors.
These people are very good guys. Serious about putting out books.
Yeah, they really are. And... they wanted two, so you took a sabbatical, Brian Grulley, from the daily toil of reporting, a business reporter, feature writer for Bloomberg Business. You write about it in Publishers Weekly. Again, you can Google this, ladies and gentlemen, and read what he has to say. It's a fascinating piece, Brian. You wrote it, that you approached this sabbatical, a six-week sabbatical with a mixture of... excitement and apprehension. I can understand that. You also found time to go on a trip to New York with your wife. You took a trip to Northern Michigan with your family.
I was writing,
and you're right, but you got down to a really good routine. And I am thinking, I'm not trying to force you out of the journalism game, but that must have been a very interesting taste of what it might be like to be Michael Conley, for instance, and to be a fiction writer full time.
Well, except for the $40,000 royalty checks every week. Yeah, I didn't get any of those.
Yeah. But that.
It gave me a taste of what it would be like to, you know, get up, work, maybe do other things, work again. You have to do the work. And I enjoyed the work itself.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed everything else. And, you know, I've been, like you, Rick, I've been a journalist a long time. And I've loved it, but maybe I could try something else.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Do you have, I mean, it's hard to have, you know, and you've been in this business long enough, it's hard to have a kind of expectations for one's book. I mean, I'm hoping you think, well, Rick liked it. Rick thought it was good, and that's something.
Should sell 1 million copies.
Yeah, I know. You know what I mean? I mean, it's like tossing a baby bird into the sky, hoping it'll fly.
It's like on a beach. You're throwing a bottle off a beach with a message in it and hoping somebody will pick it up. You know,
this second
show it to somebody else.
I know you didn't write the second in the.
I'm close. I'm almost done.
Are you?
Yeah.
I know you didn't write it in 6 weeks, is what I was going to say.
Well, I used that as, I just needed that, like, boost.
Yeah.
You know, that
were you having, did the 6 weeks help solidify plot movement.
It just,
and,
you know, it was just, I got to focus, and yeah. I got a lot done in that 6 weeks. But still, right now, you know, I'm a few weeks from finishing the first draft, and then I have things to do to finish. And it's Bleak Harbor, you know, people say it's pretty dark, but I think the next book makes us, at times, I think, you know, Bleak Harbor's kind of like a Flintstones episode.
Well, but I'm telling you, it's alluringly dark. I found it alluringly dark. I mean,
If you think this is alluring, then you'll love the next book, which is called Purgatory Bay.
Brian, I love this book. I love this book. How important is it? We were talking off air for a second about Courtney Wright, the husband, late husband of Sarah Paretsky, who was an inspiration to her, and the great sounding board. You have a wife and family. It is hard, or I would probably say impossible, to not have support and produce what you produce.
Oh, my wife is...
Pam is her name.
Pam is my wife, and she's the best part of my life. And she's there, and she's very patient with my insecurities.
Yeah.
I'm a writer.
Yes,
so
you are.
I'm insecure about my writing, and she supports me, and then she tells me I'm full of crap. And
that's
important. Just go on and write.
That's important, too.
And... one of my daughters likes to read my stuff early, and they're all very supportive. They all think it's pretty cool that I'm a writer.
Yeah. Do you think it's cool that you're a writer? I mean, you did come to this relatively... I know you thought you had nothing to say when you were 21 years old, but, you know, you and I are older than, let's say, Marcus is, for instance.
Marcus Aurelius.
Yeah, Marcus. Yeah. Marcus.
We're older than
the only one I know. Yeah, I feel older than Marcus Aurelius, but we are older than Marcus Seiki, who started a little earlier in the game than you did.
Yeah.
But you still must feel an incredible amount of satisfaction. Personal satisfaction.
I'm happy that I finished these books, Rick, but I'm like, you know, most of my head and heart are in the next book.
Yeah.
And it's a mess right now, and I'm going to fix it. I know it'll be good in the end, but that's where I am. And I'm hoping like Bleak Harbor, and some people like it and some people don't.
Well, I don't know who wouldn't like this. You know, but that's the thing. Nobody. There's some people who don't like the Bible. There's some people who don't like Gillian Flynn's book. Too long. Too many. The chapters are too short. The chapters are too short.
Unlikable characters.
There are people who don't like Gillian Flynn's books. There's always going to be somebody who doesn't like something. I love Bleak Harbor and whatever, however you have helped our mutual friend Jonathan Eich make his paperback even better. He will be Brian Grulywell with Jonathan Eich at the bookseller at 7 o'clock Tuesday evening. Then if you happen to be in Scottsdale, he'll be in Scottsdale the following night. So no drinking at the bookseller, Brian Grulywell. No drinking or drinking just walk to the airport. Brian, it's great to see you, and congratulations.
You too, Rick.
I mean, I'm watching your career. I can't wait for the next one. Do you have a rough pub date? You have a title?
The title is Purgatory Bay.
Purgatory Bay.
Happy title.
Yes, very happy.
And tentative pub date, January 2020.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
We already have pre-orders.
Really?
People have already pre-ordered a book that does not exist.
That's fantastic.
Thank God they haven't seen the manuscript.
Yeah, stop.
They would rescind their pre-order.
Stop. You can't rescind the pre-order. We got to get some commercials, and I'll let Brian go home to his lovely wife, Pam. I will tell you once again about this very important benefit concert for a man named Ralph Wilder, who's been an important figure on the Chicago music scene and who was paralyzed in a terrible accident. And the benefit is to help him recover and help him get back on his feet. It takes place Monday, December 10th at 8 o'clock at Northeastern Illinois University. He has a GoFundMe page that's Help the Wilder Family. And do your best. I'll tell you about it next week, too. Thanks a million for listening to this abbreviated version of After Hours with me and Brian Grulywell talking about his latest novel, Bleak Harbor. I will see you next week. Have a safe, warm week.